Thank you, Sarah, and thanks for organizing this, and thank you all for having us here. We're really excited. Michelle is going to be mainly speaking today. This is how we're going to structure things. We have a group of people. We call ourselves the Elsinore Bennu Think Tank for Restorative Justice, and we are writing a book right now. Which is called Life, we're not writing it, we're editing it, right, which is called Life Sentences. The essays and other writings in this book are by incarcerated people who are serving life sentences, and so therefore life sentences. We thought it was sort of catchy. And so they've written the essays other poems and other kinds of things, and we're organizing them and editing them now for publication into this book, Life Sentences. So we thought it would be great to get a chance to come out and talk with you guys about some of the insights that we've gotten from editing this book. And so the way we've organized this 4-week series is each week we're going to be talking about a different subject from our Life Sentences book. Okay, and so this week, what Michelle Grissom will be talking about is life before incarceration. She is the daughter of Khalifa, who is one of the main authors of our book. And Khalifa has recently passed. Khalifa died, was it 2 months ago now? Is it December 7th. Yeah, Khalifa died unexpectedly December 7th of cancer that hadn't been diagnosed. So we've been thinking Khalifa is very much on our minds right now. And I think as soon as, when Khalifa passed, it brought us all together. And Michelle and her mother, Helen, became Khalifa's wife, became very interested in participating actively in editing this book, and have both been, really crucial parts of this process, this writing process. And so I guess with no further ado, I will mention, I will introduce Michelle Grissom, our co-editor, Elsinore Bennu Think Tank, passionate advocate for incarcerated people, daughter of Khalifa. Excuse me. And her son William is here too. William, at some point, he's going to listen for a while. At some point, we may move on to a different location.
Is this one? Hi, I'm Michelle, as you all heard. And oh, thank you. Sorry. This is something that I'm really proud of myself for being a part of. I'm sorry. But yes, Khalifa was my father. He passed away 12/7 of 2017. And I thought this was a great thing to do and be a part of, as well as for my mother as well. She couldn't make it, unfortunately, today. She lives in New York, so I'm here. But did everyone get their sheet? This is something my father wrote. It's a lot of, in this book, it's from the life first. It's their stories, their thoughts on everything. And would you all like me to read this, or just, I think I'll read it, okay? It's called See Me. Wasn't a damn thing recognizable to me except the manpower office building that was across the street from Shaw Avenue grade school. Prior to me being sent to Thornhill Institution, I was attending Walnut Street School and knew everybody in the school. After all, we mostly lived in the projects and hung out together. Well, we had cliques, of course, but Harrison Village had its own identity. And we rode on that. Everybody was scraping to get scraping to get by, but we didn't know the difference because no one stood above the other. There was someone in every section that drank or worked in the mill or was on welfare or in every... I'm sorry. Where am I at? Okay. Or in every section that drank, worked, or in the mill, or was on welfare, or in many cases, both. Most tenants were actually married, but all their husbands had mill, weekend girlfriends. There were constantly people coming up from the south, staying like a summer, there disappearing again. The same with folk from Cleveland, Ohio. They were usually kind of young and fine, so we made it our business to befriend them. I had about 4 months to go before graduating from Shaw and moving on to junior high. At least I hoped. It had become somewhat of a joke that I'd be home to start a school year. More often than not, I was asked, did I run away from some joint or am I home on some type of extended summer vacation? I wasn't bad, more delinquent than anything, full of curiosity and a little too much heart for a little guy. Up to this point, I hadn't really hurt anyone, aside from fist fights, which I had to receive some scars, black eyes as well, missing teeth. But it was that kind of space we're all in, basically a four-block square that everything happened in, unless, of course, we decided to go to Kennywood Park or Eaton Park, skating rink. And truthfully speaking, we all were quite country. At least that's how I was accepted in the juvenile joints I had been in. And by the time I had several trips to juvenile court, a camp from wayward youth called Sleepy Hollow, a foster home, a transit home in Thornhill. But now standing in the schoolyard of Shaw Avenue was actually the first time I felt I was somewhere I didn't belong. Of course, there were a few white kids in those institutions, but for the most part, you could tell they were some welfare living dudes too. Besides, they were pretty game as far as getting into trouble. But these cats out here with me now in this schoolyard were clearly a different breed. They had school bags and nice tan pants with blue shirts and shined loafers, haircuts, and you could hear some jingle in their pockets. But I didn't know none of them, and that felt really strange to me. I wandered over by the huge black chain that cordoned off the teacher's parking lot and stood by myself. They were running past me, laughing and tagging each other as if I wasn't ever standing there. I watched one dude try jumping the chair barrier and not quite getting his lead foot high enough and bite the asphalt. Damn, he hit kind of hard, mostly because he didn't know how to break his fall or roll with it. I mean, he just hit splat. A couple kids came over after he didn't get right back up and stood, looking at him, until finally he rolled over and sat up, a little blood now, showing through his pretty little blue shirt. His knee was sort scraped, but no real damage as far as I could see. Raising his arm, I could see he was wiping away what looked like some tears about to fall. And some little black-haired girl asked, was he okay? He shook his head, got up with the help of two of his buddies and hobbled over to the steps leading inside the school. I guess he was going to the nurse's room and get some attention. I thought to myself, I'm not going to say that word. Okay. That's the story on the corner tonight. And then it hit me. No one said two words to me. I mean, I was standing no more than 2 feet from the entire incident, and they acted like I wasn't ever there. No. Excuse me. Hey, are you new here? What's your name? What grade you're in? Instead, I felt like one of those black jockey lawn lights you see on the lawns of the homes up by the library. I felt invisible, and I felt alone. I felt naked. But because I didn't even have my fish knife with me to back my often smart butt mouth up, I was known for saying stuff. If I thought you were playing past me or ignore me, actually I would just feel inferior and want to make a statement because I am here. I am real. I heard another bell go off in the school, and it was then noticed that another grade was coming out to the yard. I stood looking at the door, hoping to see some familiar face. Even someone I didn't get along with would have been okay for right now. Plus, it would give me a chance to holler across the yard and to call to attention. I'm alive. I'm not the colored landscape piece planted to designate the parking lot. I am breathing and now plotting on getting a couple of you real happy punks for your lunch money just because you don't see me. Out of the doors came my relief, wearing over ironed and out of season corduroy pants, and a pressed Bourlon shirt that shouldn't have beard, ironed in the first place. But that was my partner, Dory Ray. Yo, Donnie, what's happening? He was equally glad to see me, too. Not that he didn't know some of the kids in the yard. This was the first day he'd seen me without a family member with me since I had gotten home from the joint. We greeted each other with the slapping of hands and the giving of five, because that's what separated cool dudes from squares, you know. Now I had the comfort zone that allowed me to take a cigarette out and light up. A lucky strike. One of my dads, of course, but it would certainly do. I know I was feeling better because I sort of hitched up my pants. I felt rather naked before his arrival. And as we were talking and he was briefing me on the targets, Greg came out and he spotted us first, hollering and putting that strutty walk down, crossing the yard to us. Oh, finally a shirt. Now that was starch and obviously catching the eye of the yard. Greg was a show enough country boy, unusually strong for his age and size, big lips and head, stocky built and always ready to fight. And here he was calling and coming over to me. It's on now. I could see the cats looking, wondering who is that? What's his name? How he know Donnie and Greg? Is he like them? Needless to say, when the bell rang again, that was our sign to slip away and head downtown. It wasn't, but a block away, and wouldn't nobody miss us. And it would give me a chance to catch up on what this school is about and what vulnerable honeys were on the limb. Naturally, we walked towards the state store, and after a few minutes, saw Bubba. We pitched in and bought two quarts of Muscatel wine, and went up to Water Street, stopping briefly at Barb's store and buying some juicy fruit gum. We crossed Water Street, hopped the fence, and went down on the riverbank and cracked the wine. Damn, it felt good to be with my own cats. I had run the streets with, stuck up drunks with, pulled trains on girlies under the stairwell, in the projects, and hustled stolen goods from downtown. They were better than my brothers to me, and so I thought it only fitted I put them down with some cats I had met in Thornhill, but lived where they called the city. I told them they were some cool cats from Homewood, some I'd known from living in East Liberty, but hadn't seen since being displaced back in the port and from Northside. Although they were eager to hear the stories of times I had run away from the joint with these cats, they still had reservations about coming to Pittsburgh with me on the weekend, but it was good to see them, especially at the same school I was placed in. I knew it was going to be a fun-filled 3 or 4 months of hustling, bullying, a new girl who sought out titles for hanging with and knowing bad boys. I knew in my mind I was going to make them pay for not seeing me, for not speaking to me, for acting like I wasn't there or had some disease. It was the same feeling I was experiencing now, weighing this life sentence. No one really wanted to be around, not knowing what I might do or when the impact of it would cause me to snap out and act like I don't care about nothing anymore. Truth is, I hadn't took a deep breath yet. Everything was shallow, quick, and numb. I guess the only thing that stood out in my mind is that I didn't feel alive. I didn't feel like anyone cared or that anyone even knew what was happening to me, inside me. Hell, I didn't know myself and couldn't have explained it if someone were to ask. Everyone in the county kind of gave me a little more space. Few words, unless I initiated conversation and always, always looked at me quizzically after getting high. I certainly felt their learningness. After all, there were guys in the county with me that I had stuck up on the streets and had heard I was some crazy gun tie and snap out case with no ties. They were wrong. At least I thought to. I had ties. Until I was sentenced to life, to make matters worse, I didn't have a clue as to how I was going to deal with this, let alone make it through it. So I told myself this isn't really what happened, and that for the time being became my state mind, Khalifa. This is just one of the so many stories that my father wrote. From the time he went in to the time he passed away, he was writing. He was thinking on a hospital bed. He was. And it helped me. I'll be 42 on the 16th, so he was in there forever, my whole life. But it helped me understand the life before he went and then the life that he had when he passed. I was like, wow. You know, it's like, it's two different people. You know, it was hard growing up. You know, I'm the daughter of Richard Khalifa Diggs. His real name is Richard Diggs. He got Khalifa once he went to prison, and he changed his whole life around. He began to speak with children. They will bring in my area our schools growing up in Homewood and Wilkinsburg. You know, it was hard without a father, but the schools would take us on tours to facilities. And one thing that made us really, really, it was a beautiful thing knowing how my father did change as a person, and he also helped and changed others. Because after he passed, we went and got all his belongings, and he saved everything. There were people that have went incarcerated, young men that was incarcerated, who have gotten out, that was communicating still with my father because he has changed their life tremendously. It's the community now, where the community that I'm from, I didn't raise my children in home with my mother. We moved to Buffalo, New York, you know, where it's cold when it snows and all of that. So she did teach us, just because you're from a community don't mean you don't, you know, respect the struggle it is and get out. You don't have to be trapped, because the life before incarceration, it is a struggle. It's hard, and it's easier for women than it is males in the, from where I'm from, the Wilkinsburg, Homewood, East Liberty community, because there's a lack of, I would say, teamwork, community work, you know, all the residents. You know, they don't have all the neighborhood, you know, older parents get to, you know, try and make it better for them, for the children that's growing up. So it's hard, because a lot of them, they don't have. A lot of the kids are institutionalized about the time they're the age of 12 or 13. And it's hard. They have children, 2-3 kids, about the time they're 18, 19. Yeah, it's hard. They're not wealthy. And one thing that I was taught, and he taught me, is because he just taught me not to be one of those who say, hey, welfare. That's one thing I was blessed with. My mother worked hard, so I had two children by the time I was 18. And I moved as soon as I had my first one. He was a boy. My father told me, no, you cannot raise him in Wilkinsburg. You can't do this and you can't do that. Just because he learned from all his mistakes. And he gave me a positive everything. I got out of the, you know, they call it the hood in here, or, you know, you really don't hear ghetto anymore. They say the hood, but yeah, I got them out of there. He taught me, I wasn't a boy, but he did also teach me to have respect for myself as a woman because of, as he called it, in some of these, you know, their little hotties and honeys and all that other stuff. But he still was able to be a father from the inside out. You know, he spoke again. He spoke with a lot of young youth once he got later on because he was in there. It was 42 years. It was about to be 43. His grandchildren... I'm sorry. His grandchildren, I didn't let, just because he was incarcerated, they couldn't know their grandfather. That would have been the bad part of me. But the good thing about it is, when I did take him, he did let them know, this is not where you want to be. This is where you stay away from. And this is anything pertaining to the anything going in the inside to keep you from in there, you just stay away from. You know, he was a grandfather from the inside. He was a father from the inside. Just because he was in there, it didn't make me look at him different. My mother didn't raise me that way. You know, everyone makes mistakes. The mistakes they made may have really, you know, hurt other families, hurt people, hurt a lot. But you learn, you get older. He was young and dumb, but when he died, he was wise. He was very, very wise. And I got to know from all his writings, I have boxes and boxes, his whole life story, from the beginning to the end, on from when he got in trouble, from when he didn't. His life before incarceration. I know his whole life, and I wasn't even born yet. From grade school, the tough times he had, the struggling that his parents had, the everything. But it's different when you don't come from a wealthy, you know, he wasn't wealthy at all. So, any questions or anything? I'm sorry. This is, none? Yes? Oh, thank you. I'm so nervous. I took all the notes on my phone, and Elaine said, hey, you want to do the speaking? I'm like, okay. Because we've been so caught up on this book. All my concentration's been on the book. So I'm like, what am I going to talk about? But thank you.
How do you think we can make some changes in areas? We're new to Pittsburgh, so.
Okay.
But how can we make some changes to areas like Homewood or wherever else in Pittsburgh that's a... Not a good place.
There's the first thing I would say is start with the youth. You know, the older ones, it's hard getting to the parents of the youth, you know, to get together. And I've tried, we've tried, we're doing the best we can. Is there any Kleenex around here? Sorry. And, but it's getting to the youth. You know, they don't have, in all those areas, they tore down the libraries. And, you know, back when I was growing up, thank you, they had libraries and where our parents could take us. And, you know, they had storytelling time at the libraries. They had lunch programs. It starts with the youth. They need, like, the community, like, just getting that team together to just go and show the youth that just because you live here don't mean it has to, you know. Like, last year, me and a couple of my girlfriends, we got together and for Thanksgiving, because we cook every year because I like to bake. So I bake a whole lot. My grandmother in New York owns a bakery. So we baked, and we're like, hey, since we're going to go cook, you know, we cook on Thanksgiving. Let's not, whatever we're going to spend on cooking, let's just cook and just take it to shelters. So there's a few women's shelters in Homewood. We took Thanksgiving dinner and just passed it out. And then my older brother, he owns a bar and grill. So I put a box there, and whoever donated socks, scarves, and stuff like that, you know. But it starts with the youth.
It does. Do they have something where kids that are in school and struggling, where they can go someplace and other people help them with math or spelling?
Nope. Everything, it's... No, there's not too many of those. And a lot of children need that. And that's where it also starts, because if they see that they can't do it, they're going to lose interest in school. You know, and then, you know, I can't do it, I can't do it. I always teach mine that can't isn't a word. You know, that's how I was raised. Don't say you can't, because you can do anything. But they need programs, they need the time. For the buses, there's no bus monitors on their school buses, and it's, yeah, they just can't afford any of that. So kids are being teased on buses, and it's, yeah. But there's really not any too many programs. If you do, you'll find one. In the after-school programs that I think the community should have is, you know, one that at least could stay open till about 6 or 6:30, because after school, you know, you go to the after-school program and serve, like, a meal there, because some of these children, they don't even, you know, they have one meal a day. That's why I show so much interest in the lower communities. Yes. Yes.
I think you said he was in prison for 40 years.
Yes.
Okay. During that time, he had a lot of time to think. Mm-hmm. Did he ever express himself about regrets or how his life could have been different? What might have made a difference in his life so he wouldn't end up in prison?
Yes. His parents were on drugs, you know. He thinks him faulting his parents in the way that they were, he used that for an excuse when he said he should have used it as a way to get out. He shouldn't have been just the kid like, oh, they're doing this. He said because he had places to go, well, like over a cousin's or an aunt's or something, and he could have moved out of town, and he chose not to. But then when I asked him why, like, why, Dad? He says, you know, being one thing, being a father, but then when your mom, he says he had to be there for his mom, you know, even though she was on drugs and stuff like that. So he just went and get out. He wished he could change everything, but he couldn't. And I guess the sentencing was different back then. And when he did go, he wasn't the trigger man. He was with someone. The they call him the trigger man back then, the gunman. It was. And he was with someone who actually did it. But he didn't tell. So that made him just as guilty as the man that pulled the trigger.
Not the law, yes, but he probably felt that was a terrible injustice that he was not the trigger man, but yet he was in prison for murder, which he didn't commit. I gather he felt that was very unjust.
I asked him about that, but his answer was he did so much in his life, and he hurt so many because he was 20-something years old when he went. So he said that was just his past. They call it your past catching up to you. So he didn't get caught for anything else he did, but he got caught for that one. So he accepted it, but he said he wished he could have done a lot of things different. That's what made him change his life while he was in there. Because he would see the people, the young men that was coming in. Because he said as the years went on, they would come in younger and younger and younger. And that's what made him start helping. So, and he helped a lot. When I say I have boxes and boxes of stuff, it's from 10 and 11-year-olds who are now 30 and my age now, who literally was like, you helped me. And then my brother was on the street. My brother works for Port Authority. He said he was on the street downtown. He drives the Port Authority cars or utility trucks, whatever they are. And he was in front of McDonald's. And this man walked past him. He told the story at the funeral. He said, so he seen a man. So then he said he seen a man walk past him again. And the man keeps staring at him. So he said it was a third time. He said, so he kind of got nervous because it was early in the morning about, because he works the early shift. So he said it was had to be about between 6, 6:30 because McDonald's just opened. So he said he got kind of nervous because it's downtown on Stanwix Avenue. So he said he grabbed he had like a stick in his car because he seen the man coming towards him. So when the man got to the car, he said, can I help you? And he says, are you Khalifa's son? And he's looking at him like, okay, no. My dad's been incarcerated for my whole life. So, and, well, he was 2, I believe, when he went to jail. But, so he was like, yes. And he was like, I just want you to know your father saved my life. That man did 10 years. My father helped him through everything while he was incarcerated down the SCI, Pittsburgh. And he said, that man said, can I buy you a coffee? And he said it just brought tears to his eyes. But he told that man, no, you do not have to buy me a coffee. I'm going to buy you one. Because he said he just made his day. Because being a man, a young boy growing up without a father, it's different. Like when I say he held a grudge for years. Years. My brother's 2 years older than me. Yeah, he was 2 when our father went. But I'm talking 20 and 25 years of a grudge because he wanted what every other little boy wanted was a father at the football games, at this. But he said that put a whole smile on his face when he said that because the man, before he got incarcerated, he wasn't allowed to see his children. He was on drugs. He had no education. He went down to SCI Pittsburgh. He then got his carpentry. I guess they have school trades you can do in the prisons. So he got that. He got out after 10 years. He actually just got custody of his children. And his life is better. But he told my brother, your father saved my life. And that's just one of many great stories. So, yes.
You said your father was very wise.
He was.
At the end of his life, did that start early?
It's
one for a long time?
Yes. He started changing when I was about... when he realized and when he became Khalifa. That's what I call it. Richard Diggs is who he was in the streets. Khalifa was a new person. I was about 11. I was 11, 12 years old.
Mm-hmm. And you remember the change?
The change?
You remember him changing?
I do. I remember every bit of it. And then you should. And then by me reading more, there's a lot of things I forgot. But by me reading his stories, because he was very organized. Elena tell you that because she spent a lot of time with him. A lot. Many years. Her and Norm. Norman will be the next speaker. They spent a lot of time. But he, he was very organized. So when he has each step from the time he went in and being incarcerated to the time he was actually typing when he passed away. Well, typing all the way up until, like I said, he was in the hospital just thinking. Mm-hmm. He was really, really wise. Yes.
I'm really interested in that you said you read everything you wrote his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in when you started reading that and what that experience was like.
When he wrote home, when my father would write, he would start off as a story. And then he'll go into like, well, hey, beautiful, like when he writes to my mother. And in a book, that's how a lot of it was. We was like, how are we going to do this? And how are we going to, you know, of his words, how are we going to get this in a book? Because all his stories and in the of his life started with the letter. How this letter started, this is how his letters are stored. And then after he signed his name, then right underneath he'll say, so how's my beauty? So how's, you know, so that's how, through all his letters, he said, I would rather you hear it from me than like, oh, how was he? Like, don't figure anything out by pictures. Don't look at anything. Don't take, you know, someone say, oh, I know him. I know Ricky, because they called him Ricky. But, a bunch of stories. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
Was that in a formal sort of way, or did he just in prison get to know people in an informal way? Was there a program or something like that in the prison?
He's part of the think tank that he was part of that.
Okay. And how long has that been going?
4 years.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. He helped them find a lot. The young children that will come in, if he's like, oh, this is one that needs, you know, this is a tough one. And he said there was many, many tough ones. So, he will get them. He got several. I still keep in contact with one to this day. My mother do as well. His name is Malachi. He's also in the book. He actually asked my mother to be his godmother, but he's like 30 years old. But anyone, he helped. And then whenever they would bring in the school children, because they would bring them in high school and from middle school. It was never anyone in elementary, but from like about the 8th grade up. Mm-hmm. And some he kept in touch with, and he told them, this is not where you want to be. You know, like, this is not the life you want to lead. So he helped them in and out as much as possible. Yes.
Obviously, he communicated through his writings, but did you see him often?
Yes. Mm-hmm. All the time. That's one thing she didn't take from me. My mother, well, she never took anything from me, but she left it as my choice, as that when I got older, if I wanted to still continue to see him there or if I just wanted to let it go. But I'm glad she did. I'm so glad she did, because just because I have a father who's incarcerated, that didn't mean I never wanted to know him. You know, even though I like Khalifa better, I still call him Khalifa. You know, instead, because it was Dad, but you know, Dad was Richard, so, and Khalifa was father, because
you went in there as Richard, as, you know, one of the, you know, you had to play like you was a tough guy or whatever you were back then. And he changed. And I, you know, I didn't keep his grandkids. My oldest is 25. My daughter will be 23. And, yeah, then I got a five-year-old. But, yeah, I didn't keep them, and they love him. They loved every bit of him because that was their grandfather. You know? They knew him as Khalifa.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Was he incarcerated this whole time until he died?
Yes. And, that's the sad part because they were denying him medical attention at SCI. He would put in slips and slips. So then he put in, it was his sixth slip. Because actually by the time they took him to the hospital, SCI was closed and they moved him out by Erie. So my mother had to call up to Harrisburg, and she spoke with the person that's in charge of the whole, I guess, medical things. And she says, okay, tell him to put in a slip, and we'll take him. And they put in a slip. Mind you, my father was, his stomach was swollen out to here. Everyone seen it and was like, you're sick. So when he went, he had, he died of liver cancer. Mm-hmm. They took him to Hammond, out Erie. They took him to Hammond. He was there for a week and a half. Mm-hmm. And he died that quick. That quick. Yes.
The chaplain from the SCI Pittsburgh mm-hmm. did a seminar here a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, did the church or the Bible or pastors, chaplains, play any role in your father's life?
Yes. One even came to the funeral. We had a lot of them. We had a sergeant come to the funeral and speak. Several of them. Several people came. Mm-hmm.
Did he ever read the Bible?
Mm-hmm. He did. He did. He read the Bible. And my mom's different. My mom's Jehovah's Witness. She's been for about 5 or 6 years. But he was not. He stayed in his Bible. He did read the Bible. He did.
Did he ever talk about that?
About reading the Bible?
Yeah, about what it meant.
Mm-hmm. He has writings. You know, and sometimes he'll write with Bible verses at the end of, well, he'll put one. Even before my mother got into her Jehovah's Witness, he would write, you know how some people put Bible verses at the bottom. And he'll say, just read this. If you're having a bad day, he'll say, read this. This will get you through the week. He did that a lot. Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Khalifa, I guess that's, you know, he chose that. No, he chose Khalifa. He chose.
Do you know what it means?
No, I don't. I don't know what Khalifa means. It means something. It does. And it is in one of his, I can't think of it. He yes, because he told me what it was, because when I was having my son, he told me to name him something. Mm-hmm. No, when I was having my daughter. He said, name her Asada. It means this, 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 and that. Yeah, so.
So you're sharing with your grandfather. Do you think that's unusual or rare?
What?
You have a very constructive, loving relationship with your grandfather.
Khalifa?
Yeah.
That's my dad.
I'm sorry, your dad.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you
think that's rare?
Or for him to change his name?
No. For you to... I mean, so many people in communities like Homewood don't have a relationship with their dad, their grandfather, whatever.
It is rare because, again, it starts from your parents. My mother didn't keep that from me. You know, she didn't keep it. You know, she didn't... No, you're not going to go see him because he's incarcerated. She let me make that choice. That is a blessing. And which I think a lot of these, because you know they're younger as they're getting incarcerated now. And actually now I think that they need to, even though some may be against it. Oh, I don't want my child going into no facility. He's not going to go see this. He's not going to go see that. Well, in order for him to know, because I can always tell my child, you're not going to go see him in there. And this, you know, I don't know anything about the inside of incarceration. Khalifa did, you know, and I think the mothers take that from their young children. Like, don't have your children not interacting with their grandfather, their father, their uncle, anyone that can help them stay from the inside. Coming from Homewood, Wilkinsburg, and East Liberty, and all those areas, you know, because it's a high chance. Like, they need even though their father isn't in their life, they should at least give their father the opportunity to let their child know this is not the life you want to live. You know, rather the mom wants to take him, the mother can have a friend, a grandmother, or someone take him, but I think they should let the child make that decision herself. But I also think it will be a great thing for them to see their father, because, like, oh, I don't want to go in there. I don't want to have to wait to come down for a visit. I don't want to have to do this. I don't want my mother going through coming to visit me and have to go through all these metal detectors and stuff like that. You know, they can still let them know how to be a man from the inside. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Back 7 years ago.
Yes.
About him feeling invisible. And about how the other students just didn't pay any attention to him. So gravitates to anyone he knows.
Mm-hmm.
He must not have had parents who cared very much for him.
No. Not when, you know, when you're on drugs. It was probably a total, and it was because he took on his sister's daughter and raised her until he got incarcerated. Because his sister ended up on drugs, and she had a daughter, and he ended up taking on her responsibility. Oh, yes, he did. Yes. Very, very caring. Mm-hmm. Yes. And there, he'll just sit there. Because one thing about my dad is whenever he'll just sit there, and when he thinks, he'll just write. Even if it's, if he was alive today, he always has a story. And one thing you didn't want to get him to do is start talking. Right, Elaine? Oh, honestly, if he, and about how the communities are and how the men are coming in there to this day in the prisons, he can sit here and he will talk to y'all all night if y'all were able to stay up that long. Yes. Yes.
Boy child yearning for, I wish I had a father.
Mm-hmm.
And your brother felt that.
Yes.
And it breaks my heart that how many
their fathers aren't there for them, literally or figuratively, or on drugs as a metaphor.
Yes.
The fatherless child. Is that, do you think, culturally one of the big things when you get in a community that has absent fathers?
Yes.
It's like, that to me explains why now the youngsters are going to incarcerate.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm speechless about how heartbroken those feelings must be.
It was very heartbroken for little Ricky. And that is, you know, maybe if his mother would have at least gave him the opportunity to make that choice not to see his father in there. You know, and then that's what's wrong with a lot of the community in the broken down communities these days. They're fatherless. They don't have no father. They're either dead or they're incarcerated, which is really sad. Because I remember when I was growing up, my mother was a single mother, but when she moved, we ended up moving to Squirrel Hill, but the community, it's different in broken down communities and other communities are different because I seen how it was living in a broken down community where, okay, well, that's not my child, you know, but then when we're living in a different community, it's like everyone belongs to everyone, you know, regardless of race, culture, anything, everyone belonged to everyone. If one wasn't fortunate to eat, the neighbor would say, hey, you know, and there's nothing like that in a broken down community because of their pride, you know, and if a child's father is incarcerated, it will be nice if the next father who is there can step up, you know, help this kid make it. He wants to be on a football team. He wants to be on a baseball team. Go talk to his mom and see. You know, they don't have that in the communities where they have it in some, but it's really bad. It is, because I think they should step up. I think they can also have, whenever it is football season and stuff like that, they do have the teams, but it's dangerous out there. Last year there was a shooting at a football team, at a little league football game, when I think they should be able to have certain games elsewhere. They should be able to join other leagues for these young adults, because it's for the kids. It's to help the community, like community to community. You know, if the younger kids see positive, then that's what they'll do. Like, I don't think they should steal their joy. I don't think they should.
I think it was in Allegheny County last fall that there was a request. We have 60 men come and help do fun things with the boys that are fatherless. And they got 600 men to show up. Does that ring a bell? Did that happen in Allegheny County?
I heard about that. I read it somewhere.
Yeah, in the paper. But that would be wonderful if communities could network to get the men.
Yes, yes. And that's where I think it needs to be, because they're getting incarcerated between the ages of 18 and 25, or they're losing their lives.
Has homeless at areas like that changed at all?
No.
Times?
No. No. Yes. One thing last year I do recall them doing is their water got bad, and they did it for the Homewood Little League football. The water in the city was bad. The kids needed football, so they got a lot of donations for water. They just brought nothing but water, so that was a really great thing. And see, things like that, I think, should make Channel 11 News, should make the paper when they see everyone is trying to come together. The only thing you see from Homewood and Wilkinsburg and East Liberty are killings and things like that. You don't never see anything about all the positive stuff that they have going on.
One of the things in the Harrisburg area where I came from, the church that I belonged to in Hummelstown, they got a group of people and we went down into the inner city and the kids would come and we would tutor them in a variety of subjects.
And
do they do anything like that in the homeless area?
No, they need a lot of tutoring with the Wilkinsburg, Homewood, Lincoln Larmer, I guess that's the East Liberty part. Yeah. They need a lot of that. Like right now, they were saying the Pittsburgh Public Schools were on strike. Well, with the Pittsburgh Public Schools on strike, the parents can't work because the children are in school. They're not offering any kind of daycare and or help with the children who, you know, they should have some place. Hey, let's go to a Y. And the kids can still do some type of schoolwork they should have to do.
Are there very many churches that are active in the area?
In Homewood, yes. My cousin is actually a pastor, junior pastor, down Shiloh Baptist Ministry. Yeah, that's in Homewood. Mm-hmm. It's Shiloh. Yeah, he's a minister down there. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I just want to say thank you for telling your father's story.
You're welcome. Thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Yes?
Did your dad know the positive influence he had on you and these young men that you talked about? Was he aware?
Yes.
Of the value he brought?
Yes, he was. He has saved... He cherished that. Those are the type of things that my dad cherished.
So that's kind of the purpose of his life.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We have stuff from back when kids, again, when they would send cards like thank you. And there's people, again, who's 40 years old and we read their cards. And I know a couple of the men, but they were like 9 and 10 years old. And they're my age now. And he saved all of that. Yeah, he cherished and he loved helping.
We have time for maybe just one more
question. Okay. All right. Yes.
When does the book come out?
Oh, when does the book come out?
Well, okay, so we think we have a publisher. We believe we have a publisher. Usually takes about a year. After we get there. So my guess will come out in about 1 year.
Hi, Papa. Oh, yeah, we'll do it.
And next, if I can say, next week we're going to be having a speaker come in and talk about chapter 2 of the book, the material of chapter 2 of the book, or the theme of chapter 2 of the book, which is the moment of being incarcerated. So the crime, the justice system, going through the process of becoming incarcerated. Then on week 3, we'll talk about life in the prison. And then on week 4, we'll talk about go back to revisit even some of these things that the social justice work that people within the prison are doing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.